Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Recovery Cast. This is our third episode based on our interviews with Boyd and Chris, researchers into the history and culture of 12-step fellowships. In the last interview with them, we covered mostly the 50s and 60s. In this episode, we'll discuss the 70s. We lay bare some of the painful controversies and challenges of that era, and also highlight the amazing period of growth it really was, when an imperfect generation of members, just like us, looked to the future and decided that addicts of our generation should have what they had: freedom from active addiction. They got busy and made sure it would be so. Let's just jump in now and go on that ride that was the 1970s, a truly historic period for Narcotics Anonymous.
Do you have a phrase in mind, or could you come up with a phrase that would characterize the 70s in NA?
Growth.
Yeah, you know, I'm like, Dave got clean in 1974. I got clean in 1979. I stumbled into my first NA meeting in 1978. I had absolutely no idea how tiny NA was until a while later. And, you know, all I know is it was the AA-ish meeting in town where you could say fuck and talk about dope, you know. And so it was the one that I had a preference for. But I noticed the readings were a little funny. I mean, that was my first early, and then, of course, that changed as I started to really grasp NA and then love NA. But the 70s is this period where this little white book is finding its way all over the place. The little meetings are starting, because once you have the white book, you can start a meeting. It's got all the readings. You don't even really need a format. You just pass the little white book around, read the readings, and everybody shares. And you finish with the Serenity Prayer. And so you have kind of a self-contained little seed of an NA community. And so that seed starts to take root in various cities all over the place and a little bit internationally.
Well, I think of the 70s in a lot of ways as kind of this growth in some of the infrastructure and culture. So you start having the first World Convention, right? And even though NA is not quite worldwide yet. And you start having the discussion about how to create a service structure. And you start having the first World Service Conference.
I'm going to read you a letter dated September 20th, 1971. Its return address is P.O. Box 622, Sun Valley, California. And it's from the Board of Trustees of Narcotics Anonymous. Dear friends, this letter is your invitation to a Narcotics Anonymous conference to be held on the weekend of November 5th through 7th at La Mirada Country Club in La Mirada, a suburb of southeastern Greater Los Angeles. This conference is not limited to NA members. All those interested in Narcotics Anonymous or wishing to learn more about our NA recovery program are cordially invited to attend. In addition to an official business meeting for delegates from all NA groups, we will have speaker and participation meetings, general discussion sessions, a banquet, and sufficient free time for those who wish to visit Disneyland, Knott's Berry Farm, or other nearby attractions. Come and bring your friends. The principal purpose of this conference, however, is to get together delegates from NA groups in all localities, both in the U.S. and in other countries, to establish an NA World Central Office and elect a paid, full-time business manager to be in charge of this office. The formation of a central office and the election of its manager by representatives of NA as a whole, rather than by members from any one region, were so voted by the Board of Trustees of Narcotics Anonymous at the July 23, 1971 Trustees meeting. We feel that such a World Central Office will do a great deal towards solving the communication problems that have arisen in NA during its recent period of rapid growth. We want to be sure that the experience, strength, and hope developed over the years in many areas where NA has been effective are made available to new groups everywhere. We want to be sure that requests for NA literature and for information about our fellowship are answered promptly and accurately. However, we're not inviting you to just a business meeting. important though business may be. This will be the first conference given for Narcotics Anonymous as a whole, and we'll have various types of meetings, socializing, and lots of fellowship. So please plan to attend. The more the better. Pre-registration forms are included with this letter. Please let us know if you are planning to attend. If you need additional registration forms, or if you would like more information about the conference, just write to the address on this letter, preferably Attention Conference Committee. We look forward to seeing you in November. Yours in fellowship, the Narcotics Anonymous Board of Trustees. So in this one letter, you see the birth of the World Convention, the birth of the World Service Conference, and the birth of the World Service Office. I once did a history presentation at a World Service Conference. I believe it was 2004. I presented this letter and another one from 1975, saying essentially the same thing, that an event was being planned at the 6th World Convention of NA, that is, the 6th annual occurrence of this same event, but it would be the first World Service Conference of NA. I didn't know how to reconcile this, so I just put it out there, asking if anyone knew. Jack B. was in the audience, a member who dates back that far, and he raised his hand to answer my question. He said that the 1971 event did, in fact, kickstart the process, and a meeting had been held every year since, but that the NA tree had just been adopted, and the 1976 event would be the first conference held under the new system. So there you have it, the birth and rebirth of the World Service Conference, in 1971 and 1976, respectively.
And so one of my questions, you know, to you guys is, do you see Greg P. as what's his role in influencing some of this?
I would love to actually do that study a little bit more and answer that question. I think it's very significant. I don't know if I could be more specific in characterizing it, but I know that Greg put a lot of energy and creativity into the service structure. It's, you know, he wrote The Tree, for example, and I think he was very interested in seeing NA kind of adopt a form, a shape out there. One thing that just sort of a side point that was always obvious to me when I by the time I got to the World Service Office was that if you look at the pattern of growth between AA and NA, AA grew from a central point outward. You know, there was a connection from that central point to each of the smaller AA communities that were getting started. And it was, Bill sometimes called it a benign dictatorship in a way. The founders were unequivocally in charge, and they weren't lording it over anybody, but I mean in terms of the structure. Whereas NA was a series of clones of local AA communities. And I think sometimes that fact is missed by a lot of people, that NA was autonomously cloned in various communities. And it the character, like if you look at the little habits and patterns of a local NA community, they're more likely to be the little habits and patterns of the local AA community than they are to be something borrowed from another NA community, especially in those early days. And then all, you know, I call it the diaspora of NA, all of these various tiny little white book driven meetings of people who were primarily going to AA meetings. Their sponsor was an AA sponsor. Their literature was the AA big book. They began to get connected to each other and get a kind of a thirst for a brand, an identity. And then this thing came together and started coming together in the 70s, the late 70s. But before it really started coming together, and I think getting back to Greg P., I think that was in part Greg's vision about how do we now kind of get it all connected, all of these disparate, dispersed NA communities that have been cloned off of their local AA community, how do we bring them together and make a thing out of it?
So you think it was actually Greg that was the only author of the tree, Ron? I've seen it credited to both him and Jimmy.
Yeah, I've seen it credited to them both too, but I have seen him given the primary credit. But then, you know, I got no basis for that other than that's what I've heard. You know, I've not done that research.
Well, I mean, I've heard verbally that it was, you know, that it was Greg that did the majority of it, because he had a lot of it had to do with at his job. He had a secretary, and she did a lot of his typing for him and stuff like that, as opposed to, well, Jimmy just didn't necessarily have that resource. But I'm sure there was a lot of collaboration between the two of them. Well, it's interesting. I'll just throw this out here about the tree. I've heard on a history talk that Greg gave that the tree was actually created as an olive branch for Northern California, because there was so much animosity and tension between the two that it had gotten to a point where, you know, we've got to do something. And there's supposedly in 75 or so, there's a famous meeting that they had, you know, midway or something like this. And I'm speaking from just hearing stories. I don't really recall exactly that I've seen data on this. But I do recall listening to the story in Greg's history talk about how really and truly it basically it came about from that they needed to give Northern California an olive branch, and this is what it was. So anyway, for whatever that's worth, guys.
Well, you know, it makes a little bit of sense too, because, well, there's two things that are coming to mind for me right now. One of them is the story of how somebody started a treatment center, or what do they call them, recovery house in Northern California that was kind of patterned, it sounded like, off of the big ones in Southern California. And somebody started one like that in Northern California and hired a whole bunch of the NA community.
That was the ADD Center, which was short for the Addiction Center, that was through the University of California at Berkeley.
Okay. So
there was also, in just reading Stone's book here recently, to piggyback on what Ron said, there was a house called the Cialis House that was created in San Jose a little bit after the ADD Center, and people like Ed M. and actually Bill B. went up there to run it. And left after about a year because of differences.
Wasn't that the Chrysalis House?
There you go. That, I guess that's the way you pronounce it. Yes.
Chrysalis is like the a butterfly arising from the thing. You had a different rising in mind when you called it the Cialis House.
Right.
Is it time for the interview to be over, Boyd?
It must be.
Should we turn our video cameras off?
We're starting to regress now.
We don't want to watch where this goes.
All right. Well, what I was starting to say, though, is that the rising of that place in Northern California was the significance of it is that so many of what were then the emerging old-timers of the Southern California Fellowship moved to Northern California. So there was suddenly there were two centers of Narcotics Anonymous, and there had only been one, and then the diaspora, as I've been calling it, there were two. They had these significant people with time in numbers in Northern California, and so that goes to what you were saying, Boyd, about how that starts to call for a larger for us, a service structure that reaches more than just one city.
Now, spring of 66, in Stone's book, he says a strong contingent moved north, including Charlotte, Mary, Sylvia, her brother Richard, and Scott K., which I'm assuming, was that a different Scott than the Scott from the 50s, or do you think that's the same Scott K.?
I wouldn't doubt it's the same Scott K., because even when I was at the office in the 80s, that Scott K. came around at some point. That Scott K. was not completely gone. Then the other rift, the other personality clash, and Jimmy was somewhat known for the personality clashes. The Psy one we've talked about. The other one was with Greg P. That those two were very close and had a very collaborative, close relationship for a number of years. And then there was a falling out, which is sort of legendary. And I don't know the details, and I don't know how.
You don't?
Go ahead, Boyd.
Well, no, I mean, I don't either. I've often wondered why did Jimmy kick Bob D. and Greg C. off the Board of Trustees in 79, I believe it was, when you did it, or early 80s. I'm not sure on my date right there. And I asked somebody who was around at that time, and he basically said that it had to do with that Greg had moved to Oregon and he wasn't attending the meetings anymore, but he didn't necessarily state that it was that Bob was doing that either. But I was, in looking at the dates and the times and everything, I had wondered whether it was because of that Bob and Greg were actually supporting Beau in the writing of the basic text, and it showed up out at Lincoln, Nebraska, to help, perpetuate that movement. But I don't really know. I mean, I don't even know why Beau and Jimmy had a falling out, but they sure did.
Yeah, we're going to have that conversation with Bo one of these days. But the narrative that I kind of have in my head, I try to be fairly disciplined about the narratives in my head, but they're also could very well be fed by some apocryphal stories. But that Jimmy was not exactly in favor of the writing of the basic text at the time that the basic text was written, that he felt that the fellowship's voice had not yet sufficiently matured. And on the other hand, Bo and company, who were interested in writing a basic text, their take was that Jimmy was dragging his feet, that he was kind of all talk and no action when it comes to a book. And so these two points of view start to have a growing conflict. And ultimately, Greg aligns with Bo and the writing of the basic text now, and they get busy. And so I'm not sure how much people realize that the basic text was written not by NA World Services in the form of Jimmy Kay's leadership and the office and a project that started there. It was written by, I guess I'll stick with my word, the diaspora. It was written out there by people who decided that they were just going to get it going, and that was Bo and company, and they did, and they aligned it with the World Service Conference, and they became the lit committee of the World Service Conference. But that was sort of an uneasy alliance between the conference and the office and all the parts of NA World Services. That's a bit of the backstory. So by the time the manuscript was approved by the conference, and then the office had the audacity to make a change in the manuscript before it was published, that was partly why that thing just came to such a head, because it was already a relationship of great tension. And Jimmy was pretty much not even going to the World Service Conference at that time. He's the head of the World Service Office. The World Service Conference comes to town, and he doesn't even go. That was a period of great tension. Can you guys add, either take issue with anything or any way I've characterized anything or add anything?
Okay, here we go. We're going to talk in detail now about the changes made to the manuscript of the basic text and the furor this caused at the time. The pain and the deep divisions around all of this are still the source of division and mistrust among certain members, even today. So we enter this territory with the disclaimer that we have our views and our versions of this story that result from a good faith effort to research and understand what happened, But this is not some official version. This is just our best effort to tell the story as honestly as we can. Others will, no doubt, have a different view. Before we discuss these changes to the manuscript, let me read the paragraph from the Fourth Tradition as it appeared in the draft that was approved by the conference. One might ask, are we truly autonomous? What about our service committees, our offices, activities, hotlines, and all the other things that go on in NA? The answer is that these things are not NA. They are services we utilize to help us in our recovery and to further the primary purpose of our groups. Narcotics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women, addicts meeting in groups and using a given set of principles to find freedom from addiction and a new way to live. All else is not NA. Those things we mentioned are the result of members caring enough to reach out and offer their help and experience so that our road might be easier. Whether we choose to utilize these services is up to the group. Here is how that paragraph appears now in the sixth edition. One might ask, are we truly autonomous? Don't we have service committees, offices, activities, hotlines, and other activities in NA? They are services we use to help us in our recovery and to further the primary purpose of our groups. Narcotics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women, addicts meeting in groups and using a given set of principles to find freedom from addiction and a new way to live. The services that we mentioned are the result of members who care enough to reach out and offer help and experience so that our road might be easier. End of quote. So the parts that were removed were the specific statements, these things are not NA, and all else is not NA. That's what was at issue. And a similar change was made in the ninth tradition.
During the growth of the World Service Conference, Jimmy maintained that the office was separate and that the office did not come under the instruction of the World Service Conference. And there was a huge fights about that in the early beginnings, but by taking out all is not NA, actually incorporated the World Service Office under the umbrella of the World Service Conference. So Jimmy, in his own, you know, by what's amazing to me, by his own admission of taking it out, did something that he was even opposed to before. Does that make sense? Am I?
Not really. Are you saying that by separating it from what is NA, you put it in the same category, the office and the conference?
Well, you know, what I've always interpreted was that Jimmy wanted to keep the office separate and not necessarily under the, he didn't want to have the conference control him or tell him what to do. That's basically in a nutshell of what I've always interpreted about him running the office, him putting a shield of the board of directors up against, you know, against the World Service Conference or outside issues, talking to him about it. There was a lot of friction there. And by taking out the all is not all, how is it said it's all else is not in A?
Yes.
By eliminating that right there, that in itself just says that NA is the meetings, and NA is the service structure, and NA is the business of NA, which incorporates the office to the world surface structure. Anyway, this may just be a deranged person's viewpoint here. I'm not really getting through that, I can tell, Ron.
Well, yeah, I don't see it that way. I think that what they were saying was the steps are NA, the meetings are NA, the recovery process is NA, the sponsorship relationships, you know, the core principle-based spiritual process is NA. All of that service stuff, the area, the conventions. In fact, you if you look at convention flyers for the day, they will say the Atlanta whatever convention for Narcotics Anonymous. They were trying to divorce the everything other than the meetings and the recovery process itself. That is NA. All else is not NA. That's how I interpret it.
Well, and I concur with you. I think that was Greg's spirit is what he wanted to say. But he didn't necessarily do a very good job of elaborating on that.
Yeah, and maybe they could have made a case that was coherent that could have been kept, but the way that they said it, I mean, I think in the end, obviously in the end, group conscience came down on the side of the changes that were made, just not on the side of the process by which the changes were made.
Of course not, and that's exactly right. I mean, it did, and it's not been challenged or brought to another vote ever since the 1984 decision. So,
and you know, the basic tension that you were talking about, like Jimmy saying, I don't really want the World Service Conference telling me what to do. I mean, and putting it in sort of crass terms, but he did not believe that the office should be operating at the behest of the conference. And the conference certainly believed that it needed to, and that was the showdown that occurred, and the conference had its way, right? That was the showdown that ultimately occurred. And
that's exactly what happened.
And so if you look ahead then to 1998, just jumping kind of out of the scope of what we're talking about here, but we've been doing that right along. But if you look at 1998, when the changes were made to the NA World Service structure, there was multiple budgets. There were multiple corporations at that time. There were multiple boards. The multiple corporations, at least two. There was the, you know, WSO Inc. and there was the WCC Inc., the World Convention Corporation. There was a board for the World Convention Corporation. There was a board for the World Service Office. There was a board of trustees. And there was a World Service Conference Administrative Committee. And so when that change occurred, one of the things they had to do was define this relationship between the conference and the office, because they were now combining all these boards into the World Board. And there were two, I remember Tim Banner standing at the floor of the World Service Conference trying to explain this to us and saying, it must be for our purposes internally, spiritually, it must be a relationship of direct accountability. The office must be directly accountable to the conference. However, as a matter of corporate law and the liability that could be incurred by RDs that come to the conference, et cetera, it must legally not come under the World Service Conference. And so it was really some artful lawyering that they did to walk that fine line. And they said there were two things that they did. One is there was one of the bylaws that said the office agrees to abide by motions passed at the conference. So it's sort of like this, the office agrees to abide by motions passed, something like that. So it was just a statement that you could sort of, it's not saying the office is directly accountable to the conference. It's saying when the conference passes a motion, the office freely agrees to abide by it. Okay, that was number one. And number two was the conference can remove directors of NAS by a majority vote. So but by virtue of those two pieces, Tim Banner was saying, you do now have accountability, but it's freely, it's voluntary accountability. It's not legally binding accountability in some ways, because if you did that, then that starts to give you a trail to, if the conference is being sued, if the office is being sued, well, who's the office accountable to? The conference. Where are the deep pockets in the conference? Let's start suing. You know, so there was a, it was really, Jimmy may have had more to his argument. I don't know, but he may have had more to his argument than just, I don't want them telling me what to do. But it might have been an attempt to try to craft these relationships in a way that he thought was the most sound for the fellowship. I don't know.
And thank you. I wasn't even aware about the 98 stuff. So thank you for bringing that up and sharing that for sure.
You know, the buzzwords in 98 were unified budget, single board. And then it just begs the question, what is the
what is the accountability relationship between this single board and this? The single board is the authority in terms of the legal corporation. So then where does that leave the conference? And it was a delicate conversation, because he had to say both must be true, and they both must be true in a way that's defensible legally, both being the office is accountable to the conference and the office is autonomous from the conference legally.
And now back to where we were, talking about what happened with Jimmy.
It makes me think of that kind of founder syndrome. So we're talking about this theme of founders. And how do people who are a founder of an organization, I'm just talking in general, deal with kind of the emergence of new leadership, the emergence of new ideas, of new energy? Do they embrace it? Do they fall into, this is not how we've done it, this is not the way we've done things? It's like there was an opportunity for Jimmy to embrace this effort. So it was like this injection of youth coming in and saying, we're full of piss and vinegar and we're going to make this book happen and things like that. And you know, how does that dealt with? Is it dealt with in a mentoring way? Is it dealt with in a, we're going to ignore and avoid you way? Is it dealt with in a, you're young and don't know what you're talking about type of way? You know, like some of the people, you know, like if you listen to Bo's story and you listen to him talk about kind of the era that he grew up in and the influences of him, of the, you know, being kind of a young man in the early 70s and kind of fighting the institution and things like that. And they get this idea and they want to run with it. And it's kind of met with like, hey, who are you?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's lots of evidence for that, that it, essentially that NA as an organization at that time and the leadership of NA at that time had not matured sufficiently to handle a movement like that very well. And so the result was quite a rift. And that rift, that split is still being felt.
And it's like, I think it's a microcosm of what can be seen at local home groups. You have the older members of that group, and then some new member comes in with, hey, we want to do it this way. We have this idea, and why aren't we doing this, and why aren't we doing that? And oftentimes, the older members of that group kind of have some resistance to all these new ideas. Hey, we've been doing it this way for a long time. It's working just fine, you know. Slow down, easy does it, just one idea at a time here. You don't have to come in and change everything that's been working.
Yeah, and of course, you're now talking about the phenomenon that was immortalized by Bill Wilson in the second tradition essay of the 12 and 12, when he talked about the phrases bleeding deacon and elder statesman. And it's kind of a painful fact of our history that you can look at Jimmy's role as a leader in the infancy of NA, and it was stellar. And we were talking about his role as a shepherd. It was stellar. When it came time to be the elder statesman, I'm not going to sit here and characterize it in any negative way. I'm just going to say it was a very challenging era of our history, and Jimmy was in the fray. He was not above the fray, and by the time the big fractures occurred, he was, you know, what can you guys tell us about the event that occurred where Jimmy got released from his?
I'll let Boyd kind of take that, but I just want to say that, you know, I don't think that's a unusual kind of phenomena that happens in organizations when there's that transition of leadership, you know, from the kind of founding generation to the newer generation. And I just kind of wanted to throw that out there for future discussion or whatever. But I think that what happened is not unique in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, it's just very interesting to hear you say it just like that, because we are recording this interview just 3 days, 3 or 4 days before the release of the
the second Iran story, the interview with Siamak. And he had some very interesting things to say about that. So by the time anyone hears this interview, they will have heard presumably that interview. And I would recommend it. He had some interesting things to say about, in the context of the founding generation, the rifts that occurred between the founding generation and the next generation. But his point was that there is then the third generation, the next generation, the one that doesn't have a dog in that fight, you know, then takes the ball and can really make something happen, which is how he characterized what happened in Iran. And I'm still waiting for the generation to kick some of us old farts out of the picture and take off with it.
No, Ron, that's happening now. I mean, it is. I mean, look at the growth that's gone on in the world. I mean, you know, the generation that when we created the World Board and streamline things, I mean, that's the next step that you're talking about. I mean, I think a large amount of stuff has gotten done since that. I mean, I used to almost cry in tears when I would go back and look through, you know, the World Conference report or the World Service Conference reports in the, you know, mid-90s and all the different committees that wanted motions made and stuff. And it was like, oh, my God, how are we getting anything done?
We weren't.
I know. That's exactly it. And, you know, in a conversation with George H. one time, you know, he told me that he and a few other people sat down and said, man, we got to do something about this. And it really is. It shows up in the reports. And then, so no, I mean, I think since the World Board has been created, it's been taking it to that third step that you're just talking about.
I hope that's true. Yeah. I mean, I hope that some of those changes that occurred in the late 90s and that really took off in the after 2000, that represents this. But it is a bit difficult to watch how slow motion those changes are. You know, as a guy who was involved in the 80s and just thinking it was some of the big rifts and painful divisions that were manifesting in the late 80s, early 90s, I was expecting that to sort of clear itself up anytime soon. And it's true that it did around the time that the World Board was formed, but it's also true that it resurfaced again, and here we are again.
Well, that's a perspective, too. I mean, I tend to think we give that a little bit too much attention in media. It's just my opinion on that particular thing.
I think you're right. I mean, one thing I have observed is that every World Service Conference, you start feeling like there's this drumbeat of disunity that is taking over, and everybody's scared, and you come to the World Service Conference, and there's this tremendously unified group conscience body of this fellowship that comes together year after year, conference after conference. It's really pretty impressive to see. But then there is a minority voice that makes a very, very loud case.
Yeah, but, you know, AA's got the same issues that goes on with them, too, as people very much against the office.
It's very much this phenomenon of growth that we've been talking about. How do you go from a couple thousand meetings in the world to 60,000 meetings in the world? You know, some of the changes that occur make people nostalgic for the old days.
Yeah, I mean, it's always fascinating seeing the parallels with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and these guys that did the Bill W. documentary were great in their research, kind of underpinning some of the divide that happened and the rumors around Bill kind of profiteering off the big book and so forth. And it goes back to kind of ego and split and growth and founder status. Because there's this one guy, Clarence Snyder, who for the rest of his life would, you know, say that he was a founder of AA. He founded AA in Cleveland. You know, but he made the argument in the early 40s that the Big Book was overpriced, and he wanted the Big Book to be sold for much less cost, specifically to undermine and do away with the General Service Office. You know, the Big Book was funding the General Service headquarters in New York, and we need a cheap Big Book because we don't need to be paying Bill Wilson and this office that's set up in New York. And these other tensions that exist, again, they're not unique to NA. When they talked about the issue of going from a non-alcoholic majority for the General Service Board of AA in the 50s to an alcoholic majority, that there was a lot of resistance. There was people in the fellowship who were open to having more alcoholics on the board of the General Service Board, but as long as they weren't New York alcoholics.
Yeah. Well, let me characterize what happened with Jimmy, and then I'd be interested in seeing if you see it the same way, if I miss some details. But well, we've talked about this clash between those who wrote the book and Jimmy. We talked about the changes that occurred in the first edition, and they said, well, you know, if the services are not NA, we better not endorse, finance, or lend the NA name to them. We better not accept any money from them, or we're violating the seventh tradition. They basically said it's nonsensical to say that these, what are basically elements of NA, are not NA. And so they changed it, the language. And that language change caused such a furor. You know, a worldwide group conscience of the fellowship approved this manuscript. And now it was changed by a handful of people at the World Service Office, with whom the developers of the basic text had major tension in the first place. So that change is made, and there's a showdown about it at the World Service Office, at the next World Service Conference. That showdown resulted in people being released, various people being released from their positions, including Jimmy. But the way that it ultimately played out is the World Service Conference said, edition two of the basic text will be that language put back in, done. So the first edition of the basic text did not have that language. The second edition of the basic text did say all else is not NA. And then they put it to the fellowship, and a group conscience decision at the next conference took it back out again. So they said, our primary objection, the fellowship ultimately said, our primary objection is not with the language change, it's with the manner in which the language was changed, and we have to respect a group conscience process. So I think that's the way that played out. And in the brouhaha about all of that, I was saying Jimmy was doing things like not even coming to the conference. The conference can go have its fights and do its thing, and he didn't even show up at the conference. So when they removed him from his position, he was not even present at the conference. And the story goes anyway, he was going to be told of this on Monday, but Bob Stone was hired immediately. Bob goes to the office and he begins to sort through what I was describing earlier, what he considers sort of the mess that things were in. Checks and order forms and drawers and undelivered that were old. And so Bob is kind of going like, holy cow, I've got to organize this place. And he starts taking actions that he considers to be standard during a change of leadership, like changing the locks on the doors. His intention in doing that, he told me personally, was not to lock Jimmy out. His intention was to just take a standard action, which is change the locks on the doors. And Jimmy showed up while Bob was there doing this stuff, and he kind of looked around, and in his mind he goes, oh, okay, I see what time it is. And he walked out the door and was absolutely inconsolable about that event for the rest of his life. He believed that he was being absolutely shut out. Even though Bob repeatedly told him that was not what was going on. Is there anything I've just said that you would put a different spin on or take a different direction?
Here Boyd talks about an interview he did with Lynn A. from Rochester, New York, who had moved to California and was working at the time as Jimmy's assistant.
I mean, she told me verbatim that she was in the truck when Jimmy went over to the office because they were just going to go over there and deliver some literature that he had, and that he tried to get in and couldn't get in, and his locks didn't fit, and he was mad and angry, and they went back to his house, and he went back into his bedroom and shut the door, and then came out, you know, a few hours later, and was in very, very sad, and actually she said he was crying. So there's kind of two, I think I got two interpretations here. I've got one of what you just said about he changed the locks, but Jimmy came over one day and noticed. And if Bob said that to you, that's what I'm really asking. Did he tell it to you like that, or did, what is your recollection of what Bob told you?
Well, my recollection is Bob told me he changed the locks. And he told me about it in a way that was really pained by it, because he described it as, you know, you're taking over management of an operation. You've been asked, and Bob is not one of us, right? He's a non-addict. He's a managerial type. You've been asked.
Yeah, he has no idea how many keys are out there to the office or anything like that. Yeah, I mean, I get that. I mean, I'm crystal clear on why he did it and have no qualms with it.
Yeah, just to say it, though, that, you know, those things, this is, from Bob's point of view, this is sort of a standard thing that one would do in this situation, and not an effort to shut Jimmy out or anything like that. But he could also understand how Jimmy would take it that way. You show up there, mm-hmm. and it's I don't know. You know, you say there's a version of the story that says his key didn't work in the door and he didn't get in or whatever. There's another version of the story that says he came in, he talked to Bob, or he saw Bob in there, he saw what was going on. Whatever happened, the basic facts are clear that he took that as really an affront and really a rejection. It was like, that's what I mean by he was inconsolable for the rest of his life over that. I don't think he never came back to the World Service Office, not even once. He never visited before he died.
Wow. It happens to just be one of the little quirks, I guess, that I try to figure out. I mean, the gist of it is that, you know, Bob did standard operating procedures, and sadly, you know, without communication, not necessarily that it was Bob's responsibility, but without communication, you know, Jimmy walked, kind of got blindsided. And really and truly, bottom line, has got his feelings hurt pretty bad. So
the point that I want to throw out at some point for consideration and discussion is that what's interesting to me is how defining this story is in the history. You know, I mean, it's such an impactful kind of story that's told and retold that has kind of created these divisions and so forth. And what always is interesting to me is that Narcotics Anonymous has a 12-step program that is designed to address individual defects, individual harms, that addresses shortcomings, that talks about forgiveness. And it is so hard for these principles to get applied to some of these issues for some of the people who were part of it.
Yeah, that's true.
So I was just going to ask, knowing what we know of Jimmy's personality, is there any possible way this could have been this transition of power could have been engineered in a way that would not have resulted in his just walking away and with a huge resentment?
Probably not.
I think it's a great question, and I have to agree. Like, I mean, that's kind of the hallmark signature of this whole story. He was locked out of the office. If it wasn't that, what would it have been?
Yeah, let's say that he hadn't been locked out of the office. The actual fact was the conference, the World Service Conference, took an action to remove him from his position. So that in itself, that preceded the locking locking out of the office event. So the event that removed him from his position was probably the real painful one. And then the locking out of the office was, holy shit, it's actually come to this kind of moment.
I think what's interesting is, as this has trickled down, two things that we've discussed, the removal of the literature and all the ramifications of that, the words that were removed from the fourth and ninth tradition. And that has become a totem around which people have really gathered, quite frankly, fueling an enormous resentment toward the whole NA structure. At the same time, you have somebody who's perceived to be sort of the figurehead of raw old-time NA. He was the one that removed that language. It strikes me as very ironic that there's kind of a confusing core of beliefs that this subculture has built around that really are very conflicting. They're conflicting forces within that and conflicting truths. And the fact is that the figurehead is the one that removed the language that is so upsetting to so many.
One way of looking at that is when they removed that language, Jimmy and, you know, it was a collaborative decision. There was they sat down and made that change and wrote a letter to the fellowship stating that they made that change, and they all signed it. And so that
except
was...
Except Jimmy.
What's that?
Except Jimmy.
Oh, Jimmy did not sign that?
No, he did not sign it.
Do you know that backstory?
Sure. Well, no, I don't know the backstory. I just seen the letter. And they don't even mention Jimmy in the letter. And Jimmy's signature is not on the letter. So, I just want to point that out.
So that goes to what you were saying, Dave. Maybe it wasn't Jimmy who made that change.
Well, I tend to think that it was Jimmy who brought it to their attention and said, guys, this is what I see right here, and I want to let you guys know about it. And they probably all jumped on board with his thinking. What seems to be a little funny is some of the things that went on after that I read between the lines. I mean, it's almost like Jimmy and Bill Beck kind of split from the board of from the trustees at that time, or a little bit later. Bill Beck ends up writing a letter to the Attorney General of California, specifically I haven't checked to find out what's in that letter, but it's about something that's going on that he sees within the structure. And so the trustees actually, you know, it has to do with the printing of the book, because after the decision was made that this should be taken out, there was a lot of discussion then on whether do we print the book or not print the book. And I'm actually wondering whether Jimmy and Bill Beck split on, you know, the side of we don't print the book, and the trustees took over and said we do print the book. Now, what we don't know, I mean, the only sources of material that we have really are Bob Stone's book right here. And what I've never, and sadly, you know, can't penetrate is getting into like Phil Perez, or for that matter, Fawn, of knowing, you know, what was going on in Jimmy's inner circle. And of course, Bill Beck is gone. And so I think Kevin Feige has actually passed away now too. But these are just some interesting questions that have come up to me doing a lot of this research. Because, I mean, Stone does a great, great job, you know, but there's areas that I don't think he knows about.
Yeah. Yeah, he was the first to admit that, that, you know, he told me as we were getting that book together in the end, he was saying, clearly this should not be the last edition of this book because there's a lot we don't know. You know, we start writing before we do our best to get it right, but we don't know. More will be revealed.
Well, I mean, he did the very best with all the information that he had, and he did it. I mean, he honored our fellowship. That was his gift, as far as I'm concerned, yeah. One of his major lasting gifts.
So we wrapped it up there and said our goodbyes. Our intention is to do one more of these with a focus on the writing of the basic text. But for now, those are our thoughts on this troubled but amazing period of our history, our rocky coming of age, our imperfect leaders and personalities, all cupped somehow in the palms of the hands of a higher power, as we moved on to the next era of explosive growth as a worldwide fellowship. We kept saying, okay, let's call it, and then we'd talk some more, most of which is too unfiltered and off-color to include here, as we were almost 3 hours into this interview and getting punchy. But we'll give you a snippet of some of that after-the-interview dialogue now to close out this episode. Our great thanks once again to Boyd and Chris for the service they do in adding a dimension of hard work and discipline to getting to the facts of this story that has offered so many of us freedom from the grip of active addiction. To set up this last piece, we were talking about the NA literature development process that really started with the basic text and has evolved, and just how truly collaborative it really is. We were comparing that to the AA process. We'll join the conversation there.
I ran this by the executive director of the AAGSO. I don't think they use that title, general manager or whatever. They use a falsely humble title. I don't remember what it is, but
coffee maker.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, coffee maker.
Cigarette.
I asked him one time. I'm sitting. We were having a world board meeting, and he had joined us for some portion of our meeting, so we're all out to dinner afterwards, and I'm sitting next to him. So I asked him, you know, how did NA ever get, or AA ever get by with the way they do literature without review and input? How can you call that the product of the fellowship? I mean, culturally in NA, that's sort of anathema. And he said that we do have review and input in our literature, but we have a completely different philosophy about it, which is we produce the product, we publish it, we approve it, we publish it, and then we invite, the fellowship is always invited to give us their thoughts, their recommendations for change, and we often implement them. He said, you know, if there's a wording change needed, we don't think we need another addition to make a wording change that somebody pointed out and we see as a good idea. We do it in between printings. So our books evolve a little bit. Of course, that's not true of the big book. But anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, of the Bill Wilson portion that was written, the first however many pages it is. But, yeah, Ron, when I first learned about the procedure that AA does with their books, the only thing I could think of, man, is like if the NA folks knew about this, they'd hit the roof. Yeah. It really, because it's done under lock and key.
One of the things that said is that they have a little bit of a resentment toward us for our literature process, because now, you know, the more people get exposed to us, the more that their fellowship hey, what do you mean you hired a writer and wrote a book?
Oh, know? My God, yeah.
That's great.